Okay. So welcome to the second half of the Routing Seek. Before I actually introduce Randy, our first speaker, as you probably noticed, the network has gone down, and yep, it is being fixed as we speak. So it just means you'll have to pay attention. You really will have to pay attention rather than just pretending to pay attention. Anyway, second session, we have three speakers. First up will be Randy Bush, then we have Greg Hooten, and then finally Henk Lauterveld. Henk's just fresh off a flight from Amsterdam, so I've put him last on the agenda so he can recover from that experience. First up is Randy.
Pick the worst time to lose the net, huh?
Does it help your presentation?
Well, I mean, people have something to do instead of having to listen to me. Win some, you lose some. Let's see if I can figure out how to operate this thing now. Function key is set. Already heard that one? Okay. This talk's really a few years old, but Philip asked me to give it because I think he thinks it's still relevant. It's about complexity, and really what it's about is simplicity. The internet actually does work, right? I know this will come as a shock to most people here, but... You know, we. Pardon? Well. It is still out there. IP forwarding really works. MPLS switching is a label lookup. IP forwarding is an IP lookup. It's all done with TCAMs. It's all the same story. Okay? Actual measurements show that the quality of service is just fine. If you remember Steve Kastner's measurements of transcontinental U.S., VoIP, jitter, et cetera, on just connected up to the commercial network, it works. Okay. Anyway, QoS is a decision of which packets to drop. I don't know about you, but I get paid not to drop packets. Okay, so there are reasons that the internet has taken over the data world, right, and has taken over the communications world, and so trying to turn it back into the other seems to be swimming upstream. Okay, reliability and resiliency are the core strengths of the internet. The internet was designed to provide reliable service over unreliable infrastructure. Somebody was talking about the reliability. Jeff was talking about the reliability issue. The idea is components are going to be unreliable. They will be almost as unreliable as humans. Okay? But the internet handled routing around problems. Right? Our weakness is security, as it was once the telcos, by the way. If you remember, they used to mix control and data and 2600 and Captain Crunch and all that stuff. Okay? IP routing yields as good a service as MPLS switching and better in cases of multiple failures. Routing will find a way around. MPLS, you better have configured it. To quote Mike O'Dell, the chief technologist of UUNET for many years and the hero of many of us, is the real problem is scaling. All other problems come from that. If you can make it scale, the game's over. Okay? Complexity is the arch enemy of scaling. And this is key. Because if you do something complex, your costs are non-linear as you scale. Okay? The telco culture started to glorify complexity as a competitive tactic in the 1970s and into the 80s. They wanted to compete with each other, so the big 500 kg gorillas added feature, and hung boxes on the sides of switches and boxes on the sides of boxes in order to provide perceived features to compete with each other. Okay? But look what it did to them. Right? Jeff showed you this morning the wonderful chart of those people are dying on the profit and loss statements. And they're dying on the earnings per share. And they're dying on the capital market. Okay? And we're all in a commodity market. We all buy from the same vendors as the competition. Right? Making things complex will only raise your operational costs and raise your capital costs. I do have to remind you of RFC 1925, sections 2.3. With sufficient thrust, pigs fly just fine. The question is, do you want to pay for the fuel out of your income statement? Okay? I don't. And who cares about flying pigs anyway? Okay? The Hitchhiker's Guide has a wonderful saying about the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation, their products. It's very easy to be blinded to the essential uselessness of them by the sense of achievement that you get from getting them to work at all. How many of us are mucking with networks that we're amazed but we actually get it to work? Well, maybe we've put junk in there we shouldn't. Okay? In other words, and this is the rock-solid principle on which the whole of the corporation's galaxy-wide success is founded, their fundamental design flaws are completely hidden by their superficial design flaws. Okay? Stop building artificial make-believe circuits on top of switching, on top of circuits. Okay? I've worked for the world's largest telco, and I've worked for the world's fourth largest telco, which no longer exists because they pursued this path. I'm now anonymous telling you which place I learned this. But the optics people in the telco, the people who are responsible for fiber, said, we can give them all the real circuits they want. Building circuits on top of layer two is costly to the company and damaging to the company. The problem is two things. One is the internal cost model. And that company had an internal cost model which, if you were the first user of fiber, you just wanted one lambda off that fiber, you had to pay for the whole thing. And this is very common in the telcos. So instead of lighting another fiber, they buy more routers, switches, or whatever you call these monsters these days, and build MPLS on top of them. Right? And the second one was what Jeff referred to this morning as the convergence game, which really isn't convergence. It's one department who's been at political war with the other departments for the last 50 or 100 years, saying we can provide this converged network and therefore we will subsume the frame relay people, the ATM people, the voice people, the IP people, etc., and we will give you one network and, oh, we'll manage it all. Now, what's interesting is what they did was they took a profitable frame relay business and an actual, even hard to believe, still as it was late in the 90s and early into the 2000s, a profitable ATM business and turned it into an unprofitable MPLS business. Okay? Where the smarts are is the big difference. Traditional voice had stupid edge devices, the telephone instrument we all know and love, that dialer buttons on it, and a very smart core, these monstrous switches that are very sophisticated. The internet has smart edges, this computer, undoubtedly it's smarter than I am, but that's easy, okay, with sophisticated operating systems, applications, et cetera, and a very stupid core which does packet forwarding. And a key thing here is Jeff was pointing out this morning in underlining innovation, which is critical, is adding an entirely new internet service, such as Skype, such as HTTP, et cetera, is just a matter of distributing an application to a few consenting desktops. Let's forget NATs. And you fielded it. You do not have to change the core. Think about what it takes if you want to add a service to the telco voice networks. Massive time, massive money, and you have to change the whole core of the network. Where's the reliability? The voice network has very smart central organs, which are heavily armored and have rooms full of battery backup, et cetera, et cetera. The internet assumes component failure and chooses reliability through the redundancy in the protocol designs. For instance, the root servers can be seriously attacked without anyone noticing. They were. And people had to actually show measurements of which ones weren't reachable when, because none of the users knew. Right? The protocols, find a working one and remember it until it fails. Great ones, carrier class reliability. We've got 5 or 6 9s. We can give it to you. The famous 5ESS switch regularly has 5 9s in operation and has even hit 6 9s in the field. We think we want that in routers and all other internet boxes. Could we achieve this? Well, let me tell you a secret about the 5ESS. The 5ESS somebody designed with a poor, there goes another noun, relational breakdown of its data structure. So there's data is redundant around inside the switch. So there has to be a supervisory function which continuously runs and cleans up the internal inconsistencies in those data structures. It is the majority of the code. And if it's removed, the switch crashes in a few hours. And that's your 5 9s reliability. Can you imagine this approach scaling to internet routing? You can't distribute that. Okay, does not play here. Spread it across the layers. Again, RFC 1925. It's always possible to agglutinate multiple separate problems into a single complex interdependent solution. In most cases, this is a bad idea. Don't do it. This is why ATM1 failed in the internet. It tried to solve QoS, traffic engineering, circuit simulation, all that stuff. RFC 1925 again says, every old idea will be proposed again with a different name and a different presentation regardless of whether it works. And we are now facing ATM2. Trade-offs across the layers are how to get power and simplicity. L2, L3 technologies such as flame delay, IP, MPLS have costs proportional to software costs. They drop very slowly. Fiber bandwidth and pricing seems to follow Moore's law. It's much like hardware cost. Okay, which do you want to bet on? Okay, so instead of increasing the L2, L3 cost with pseudo muxing, DWDM is your friend. Every year they get twice as many bits out of the same piece of glass. Bet on it. The cost of bandwidth is falling faster than 32 feet per second squared. Routers aren't costing less, they're costing more. My OPEX is going up because of the complexity. Get a clue. What do you do? Bet on simple and cheap. Layer one costs are driven by hardware. Layer two is driven by software. Provision the bandwidth you need. What happens when fiber keeps falling and Google and Yahoo, et cetera, provide cheap transport and the last kilometer monopoly is broken and peer-to-peer dominates and VoIP keeps exploding even though it's not bandwidth there? There's only so long the government and lawyers can save the telcos. What the second question I wanted to ask Jeff this morning, and I'll ask it now, is I think I see a game being played. It's especially visible in the States, but it's leaked to Europe and it's leaking to Asia. And that is that the trademark and copyright lawyers on the right hand are trying to label content as property so that on the left hand, the entrenched carriers who are being protected can sell the transport of a commodity product instead of a commodity service. So that's what's being called, he asked the question, the whole thing where they're doing, we'll charge Google for carrying their bits, but we'll carry our bits better, et cetera, et cetera. Net neutrality issue, et cetera. And so what's happening is on the right, they're productizing content. The Motion Picture Association, the Record Association, et cetera. And on the left, they're nailing it as, okay, now we will give you differentiated carriage of that.
I'll have a quick response to that. Yes, that is plan A from the media industry, and plan A isn't working. Expect movies to have more insidious product placement, because plan B is distribute the movie more but pack the ads inside so you actually can't filter them out. My suspicion is that movies will be sponsored by various media out there, Coca-Cola, etc., and that's their plan B. This whole issue of the telcos defending their space because they employ a lot of people and otherwise the Department of Social Security would have a huge problem on their hands is now the view of the last desperate card that they are playing. The media stuff, Google, I think, has proved that the media industry is indeed strippable and they are indeed walking right through it. BitTorrent is simply proving that the traditional distribution systems are inefficient. But that doesn't mean there's still a strong industry there. There is. You just place the ads in different spots.
That's what's happening with the whole media thing. The newspapers are losing the ad revenues. The newspapers are going online. But now Google's well ahead of them. They're going to be in deep yogurt. Okay. So the lawyers aren't going to save it, but they're working hard to muddle it in the meantime. Okay. Telcos have to save themselves. They're going to try and climb up the stack. But what they really need to do is get in front of the technology. If VoIP is so cheap, then provide it already. Provide innovative services and not video on demand, but mediated peer-to-peer, right? And do it as a commodity service with simplicity, not complexity. Because if you complicate your network, you're just going to take any money you might have made and throw it right down the drain. Okay? Going back to the cannibalization of the frame relay business by the MPLS, what happened to the profit side, the margin of the frame relay business, was it got turned into capital expenditure to put in more and more MPLS routers and into the OPEX to manage a very difficult technology. And so your margin went down the tubes by complexity. Okay? So I think with enough complexity, we strongly suspect that we can operate an approximate internet in polynomial time and dollars. That's a researcher's joke, sorry. We're working on a proof that operating the internet can be NP hard, and then we're just going to wonder where the profits went. just like the voice network. Never learn. Right? The United States didn't learn from Vietnam, and we didn't learn from the telcos. And I think that's the show.
Hi. I heard this talk before.
Affiliation?
Ed Lewis, New Star. I agree with what you're saying there about the complexity. I understand that and I use it all the time. But I want to ask a question about, there are some things that the telephone company have, some services that are regulated in, like emergency phone calls. Like we had 911 in the States. I don't know what the number is here. Looking at trying to put that stuff into the internet, you start seeing a lot of really complex solutions that are above the telco line in the software now. It looks like we're just pushing the complexity around sometimes to achieve some of the services that we've had for years in the telephone system.
I think Jeff's going to do a better job at this one than I.
When you start arguing with desperate people who see the problem about if they're going to be in business next year, they start bringing up a whole bunch of reasons why they're socially useful and that you should fund their continued existence. Most of the stuff about 911 is actually nonsense. Indeed, realistically comes the issue of where and why is there a role out there? The telcos actually operate a damn fine SDH switch with voice, you know, at the moment, and will continue to operate for some time yet. This is not a here and now problem. What they're truly trying to argue is that deregulation is hurting a lot because other people are taking niche points and taking money away from them. So you're seeing desperate people clutch at straws and argue why their role is still necessary and important and why the money should still come in that way. I'm not sure these people are believable, but that's the case they're making.
Another way of looking at that is, why isn't the demand being made of my television that I should be able to make an emergency thing over it? Why isn't the demand being made of my car? Why is it being made of the internet service? All you're trying to do is stack stuff on top of it because, oh my God, I can make it look like a circuit. Well, if you don't do that, your head won't hurt so much.
Right. Well, I'm not bringing this comment up as I've been hearing the telco say, we need this is an essential service we provided for years, now the internet has to do it. I'm looking at this as being someone who's using the internet and watching us try to replicate the same service and seeing the complexity and some of the ECRIT working group work.
Don't do it. If it hurts, stop. You're trying to solve the wrong problem or else in a disastrously wrong way.
Okay. The comment that led me to this, though, was the comment about battery backup with telephones. People say that when we have a certain, you know, power outages, you can still pick up the old POTS line and call someone. But with VoIP...
Go pick it up. Why? Just because I bought a car doesn't mean I'm going to let go of the POTS line. So if you want that service... get that service. Don't try to impose it on automobiles or televisions.
Okay, good. I guess I was just asking from the point of view. Sometimes you can take having no complexity too far, you know, making it too simple.
I wouldn't do something like that.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Randy?
I can't resist making this comment.
I'm sorry.
Item number 8 in RFC 1925 says it is more complicated than you think.
1925, yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Randy. Okay, next up we have Greg Hooden talking about real-world use of route analytics technology.
Walk around here and use the
Hi, my name's Greg Hooten, and I'm from Packet Design. We put out a product called... Thanks. called Route Explorer, and I wanted to talk to you today about route analytics and how it's used, where it's used. A little history about our company. I'm not going to go through it. You'll see it in the slide set if you want to pull it down off the web. So why route analytics? I've worked for a lot of large ISPs. Some of them went belly up. Most of them couldn't manage their networks. And a lot of the reason was because everything was focused on layer two. How do you manage a layer three network? It wasn't really known. And HP OpenView really built up this big process at layer two to figure out how the layer three worked. And that didn't work either. Most of layer three problems are caused by misconfigurations in the routers, hardware failures, and they cause a majority of the problems in the networks. What we saw at Home Corporation, where I worked before this, was when we froze the network, for example, for a holiday, essentially our outages went down by over 90%. So nobody's allowed to make changes on the network. Outages went away. That didn't catch on with a lot of people. But we tried to minimize our outages by being smarter about how we did them. But there was no way to really test, except for brute force, whether the layer three was working or not. Route analytics leverages the strength of routing by listening to the routing protocols. So if I'm listening to OSPF, I listen to the LSA information, I record what's happening in the network, I keep it historically, and it allows me to diagnose the problems either currently or historically or over time that are happening in the network. So if a problem happens once, it may happen again. If it's happened 15 times, it probably won't show up in a layer 2 management system, but it will show up in the routed infrastructure. Layer 3 is designed to survive through redundancy and through rerouting. That's good and bad. One way it says, you know, I'm going to try and get around this problem, but it also disguises there is a problem. And so we're trying to give visibility into that Layer 3 topology. Simple topology. So here's the routers. Here's a path across the network, some BGP. Some colors. It looks like a diagram. It can be changed any way you want. We tried to keep it as simple as possible. Through the reports and through very lightweight touch on the network, peering with OSPF, you get the data about what the routers are saying in the network, what routes are up, what the metrics are, what paths are down, what links are down. And then you build up over history, a timeline of what has happened, and do analysis on that type of data. These are some of the companies that are interested in this type of stuff. So MPLS seems to be our big focus recently. I don't really know why. It's a really good way of selling very large routers to the edge of your network instead of smaller routers at the edge of the network, but MPLS VPNs are catching on in a lot of tier one ISPs. One of the big problems that they're running into is change validations, saying, I'm adding a new customer to my network, how do I know it works? What they're doing right now is they're doing as much testing as they can, calling up the network and saying, all right, try it. When you go out and you add new routes to that network, how do they know that works? Okay. So they're running into per-customer reachability issues, privacy issues. Are the customer's routes really distinguished one from another? And policy issues. Am I getting the hub and spoke that I really want, or am I getting the mesh that I want? And these are the problems that they're running into. Customers leaking routes between each other because of misconfigurations. Providers trying to monitor the policy as they change it. Provider misconfigurations for various manual processes. This is a summary page of the changes that are happening in a network, detailed based on customers, so you can name them pretty much anything you want. But what we're looking at is trying to baseline what's happening in some into a network. So I've got 3 active PEs, 10 active routes for this customer. Baseline routes are 3. So I've got 7 new routes. The question is, why? So the process is really more like, if I'm making a change in the network, someone's responsible for that. Someone's responsible for saying, I'm going to add a new PE. I'm going to add a new set of routes to my network. There's also an acceptance process of, all right, once those routes are in, once those new routers are in, how does that get accepted into my network as an operational piece of equipment? And so what we're trying to do is give that data to those groups. So when I make a change to this network, customer 5, they've got 10 active PEs, 2 withdrawn routes, 100 new routes. Why do they have 100 new routes? So being able to look at those individual routes and say, these routes were assigned to this PE at this time, and these are the active routes with this route discriminator, that gives you the ability to view more detail about what's happening, saying, did this, I planned a maintenance, and I executed that maintenance, and then this is the result of that maintenance. So we've got those 100 new routes that were put in for customer 5. 13 are coming from brand new PEs for that customer. They're not part of the baseline. Is that a mistake? If they look at the work order, they should be able to tell. These are the new sets of PEs that were supposed to be added. If there weren't, did PepsiCo get crossed with Coca-Cola? Is this something that we really wanted to do? And then you can do justification on your maintenance before you contact the customer and say, this is working or this is not working. If there's instability in the network, then we can display that instability. And you want to do it with as much detail as you can. So here is just a graph of it over time. But we can also give the details about what routes were being affected at that time. So we had a large WAN RFP that required routing convergence SLA. So when does a network converge? Right now it's really difficult to measure. And what parts do you measure? Do you measure when OSPF starts to go away or once the timers have expired and the changes are occurring in the network? There's no standard for it. So what we're doing is monitoring the convergence based on the propagation delay across the network. Is that the ideal solution? No. But it worked well enough for this company to justify to their customers that they were within the specifications that were required. Do we want better solutions? Of course. Right now, being able to say, I have a monitoring system on one side, monitoring system on the other, and being able to generate route changes into the network, inject and withdraw a loopback address or /32, measuring that propagation delay across that network so that you can see this is the change and this is your graph of the change over a long period of time. Okay. Does that meet the SLA that you're interested in? By being able to look at BGP over long periods of time, you can see changes like huge deluges of routes coming into the network, whether it's a redistribution from OSPF into BGP or new changes, loss of peering. How does a loss of routing in AS1237, 7 hops away from my network, affect the way that I send data out of my network? Does it make an effect? If it does make an effect, do I want to find out why, and do I want to change that process? So we've seen this at Tier 1 ISPs all over the place, UC Berkeley, new route leakage into the network. Why did they come about? Where are they coming from? Being able to determine which customer was advertising those new set of prefixes. Where did they shift from in the entry or the entry of my network? So in this case, instead of looking at 108,000 prefixes that shifted or 330,000 events, we're going to create a pretty picture about it. And it's actually a movable picture. So we can play over time what's changing in the network. We see a large loss of prefixes across one edge. So in this case, CalREN2 is gaining prefixes or advertising prefixes across this edge. It's losing prefixes across this edge. And so it's fairly simple to see what's changing in the network. It's easy for a customer on this side to contact CalREN2 and say, look, you're losing peering here. We're picking those up. It's not really affecting us right now because we have duplicate addressing, but or duplicate address advertisements, but it needs to be fixed. And in this case, it was fairly short. The more complex problems where Sprint Link may be losing connectivity, or in this case, where Quest lost peering with CalREN or withdrew a bunch of routes to CalREN, and instead of having a simple backup, the backup path was an additional 6 hops. Really difficult to find from route advertisements. Really simple to see from a graphic. Being able to categorize route changes before and after with a delta. Here's 96,000 route count change based on next hops on this next hop. Being able to visualize those either through a table or through a graphic makes it easier to diagnose why that was happening in your network. Probably most of you have heard of MED oscillations. Probably not too many people have seen MED oscillations in the network. This is a very small cut of the data we collected at a Tier 1 ISP about a year and a half ago. The interesting thing about it was it went on for over 2 weeks. It consumed the full processing power of 3 GSRs. And nobody really knew what was going on except that they had 3 GSRs that were saturated. The changes were happening so quickly, essentially at the speed of the 3 processors for the GSRs, that they couldn't, by the time they typed a command to see what routes were changing, they were now 100 route changes behind. The changes were happening so rapidly that, and they caused so much change in their network that essentially the GSRs were useless. They started having to route around those routers to try and get data connectivity back into major parts of their network. Eventually, they shut down 2 of the routers, and they were ready to replace them with larger GSRs, which would have just exacerbated the problem. But we were able to record some of the data that was happening at that time and showed them what was happening. They implemented an always compare MED, and that essentially changed eliminated the problem. So over time, when you're capturing large amounts of data, you can also do analysis over long periods of time and look at simple changes even for a single prefix in the network. Customer/24 was flapping continuously over a 1-minute period for approximately a week. They always got backup through a NAP, but this new service that they brought from the Tier 1 ISP wasn't working for them. And so they'd spent a lot of money on a primary access that essentially was doing them no good. So we were able to look at, pull out the data and look at that and show them where the problem was and how bad the problem was. So this is a fusion, a new type of fusion that we're working on. A gentleman named Habo Yu started this, Steve Kasner and Van Jacobson decided that if we're understanding how the routing works in the network, then there must be a way to take NetFlow data, figure out where the NetFlow data is coming from, where it's going to in the network, and then instead of listening to it throughout the network, flow it across the network. So the idea here is...
Running early.
Good. So the idea here is instead of collecting NetFlow data everywhere in my network, what I really want to do is collect it at the key points in my network, entrance points, key data centers. Given that I understand how my routed topology works, I want to be able to take that data and then flow it out across that topology. What that gives me is the ability to say, if something changes in my network based on either routing or on data flow, how will that affect the other circuits that are now being overloaded? Do I buy more bandwidth? What happens if I lose a router? Where will those packets go? Will they flow the way I expect them to? Will they saturate the circuits that I have as backups? Okay. In a complex network, even with complexity coming from redundancy rather than from things like MPLS, the question is, where will my data go? It's designed to be resilient. I want to make it as predictable as possible, so being able to fail pieces of equipment proactively, testing them, seeing where yesterday's data would have flown if this router went away, gives me the ability to predict how it will happen in the future if I really do lose pieces of equipment. So being able to look at the routed topology, being able to look at NetFlow data, and then being able to fuse those two together gives me another tool that will allow me to better understand how my layer 3 topology is working, how the data will flow in the network, what capacities I need for the future, what peering I need or what private peering I need rather than buying transit from service providers. So it's another way of looking at the same types of data we've been collecting for a long period of time. And hopefully it'll add a little bit more clarity into the layer 3 network rather than trying to build that clarity up from a layer 2 network and then trying to interpret from layer 2 what the layer 3 topology will do. Are there any questions? Well, I was either very successful or you're very asleep. Okay.
No questions for Greg?
No.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, then. Thank you very much. Okay. Next up and last speaker is Hank Ottervel talking about ASN's missing in action.
That's interesting. I seem to be have a choice.
Change the frequency to 75 hertz. You can change the frequency?
Probably.
Yeah. And if you just do the presentation.
sound. Which one?
And again. Right. Now just click on the present. Yeah. Now just click on the present.
Does this work? No. Okay. There's an easy solution to this. At least there should be. Right, now you can at least see the presentation, so I'll just turn around and I'll speak loudly. Okay. So,
do you want to use this mic?
Yeah, I'll use this mic and then... Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's working. Cool. So this is work that I did with together with René Wilhelm at the RIPE-NCC on ASS missing in action, and I'll explain in a couple of slides what this is all about. Okay, so this is the outline of the talk. And this is sort of why we started doing this. We started to look at ASs, and I'm not going to explain what an AS is in this talk, since I assume that you all know that. One thing that you do know about an AS is that each AS needs its own unique identifier, its AS number. AS numbers are assigned in a hierarchical way. IANA, RIAS, sometimes a national layer, local IRs, end users. And that is to guarantee uniqueness. Obviously, if you want to do routing from one AS to another, you have to be able to say that to identify them uniquely. There are public registers available of all ASs. IANA maintains a list of what they hand out. RIAS maintains a list of what they hand out from the box they get from IANA. Another observation is that ASs are a limited resource. At the moment, there are 16 bits reserved for an AS number. 60 bits means 65,500 something. Well, a couple of them get lost for private use. There's some overhead. You cannot use all the numbers. So you only have 64,510 of them available on the net. So, who has an AS? Well, that's quite simple. If you want an AS, you go to your local, your regional internet registry, you ask for one. They all have policies. The five regions have slightly different policies. These are all based on a single document, RFC 1930. With some global twist added. And if you are in a region and you think you need an AS and you meet the requirements, you just go to your ear and you ask for one. I won't explain the policies here in detail, but one thing, and that's at the bottom of the slide, that they have in common is that they all say that you get the AS for as long as you need it. If you don't need it anymore, you're supposed to return it. So I then started to look at the RIP, and just as an exercise, I wanted to see if all the ASs that had been handed out are actually in use. And that's something that seems to be fairly obvious. I mean, the internet is a network of ASs. Every AS, in principle, wants to communicate with every other AS. So if you look at the RIP in your router, you should find all the ASs that are in use at a particular time. And ASs, like I said on the previous slide, are based on demonstrated needs. So somebody showed that he needed an AS, obviously connects to net, wants to be able, should be in your router. So naively you think all the assigned ASs are in the RIP. Well, not quite, since this is something, I looked at this about 3 years ago by now, and then I noticed a couple of things. Early 2003, the RIAS had assigned some 20,000 AS numbers, as they were assigning new ones at the rate of about 300 a month for the then four regions. However, if I look at the RIPs of a couple of routers, I only saw some 14,000 visibles, and only 200 new ones showing up every month. So, 20,000 compared to 14,000, 6,000 are missing, And there are about 100 handed out more every month than there are actually showing up on the nets. So, yeah, I was. My question was, well, what's happening here? And this work is a result of a study trying to find out what was happening here or what is happening here. So, to study this problem, you need some data. Well, fortunately, there are quite good data sources around. The first thing is Darius. They publish stats files on a daily basis with a list of all the ASs they have assigned and the dates that they were assigned. This is a daily report. Before that, they had weekly and monthly reports, but it's a daily report since sometime in 2002. Of course, if you can always work your way backwards by just taking a file and on, say, today, and if I wanted to know what was assigned yesterday, I just take today's report, I remove everything that was assigned on the last day, and I know what was assigned yesterday, so I can work my way backwards. If you do that, you find some small differences. Sometimes these files change, there's some double counting. So we worked through all these files. We removed all the mistakes that we could find. There's some double counting in there. Basically, this gave us a list of all the ASs that has been assigned at a particular time. The second thing you can look at is sort of what's happening out on the net. The RIPs. Fortunately, there are a couple of projects around that collect RIPs all over the place. One of them is the RIPNCC Routing Information Service, there is. It's a project that collects BGP info, RIPs from 450 peers, and all BGP updates on a daily basis. We looked at 5 years of data, August 2000 to August of last year. In these files, we found AS paths. So each AS path we took, we broke it down into its components, the ASs, and as soon as an AS showed up, we said, okay, it's in use on a particular day. And you have a long list of ASs and when they were used. You sometimes see so-called private AS numbers. We remove them. And we also saw some misconfigurations. People make typos, things like that. So we removed all ASs seen for less than a week. Then there's a third data source, the well-known CIDR report. That's a weekly report on the internet seen from AS 4637. Has been available since 1994, and it includes the number of ASs seen in the RIP. So we chew to all this data, and after that, we essentially have two lists. One is sort of the ASs assigned, RIA stats files, or the theory that should be out on the net, and the second list is what you see in the RIS and the CIDR reports. So that's what you see in practice. And if you put these two lists next to each other, you can have three cases. Well, the normal thing you would expect is that an AS appears in both lists. It's assigned and somebody is using it. We then found some differences. There are ASs which are in use but not assigned. And there can be two reasons for that. People can just inappropriately use them. I mean, you look at the ANA files, you say, okay, I need an AS for, and I just pick one and I announce it. Or there can be a problem with the registration mechanism. We'll get to that later. And then there are the ASs missing in action, which is an AS that has been assigned, but it's not showing up on the net. So looking further at this, AS is in use but not registered. Well, over the course of these 5 years, we found 436 ASs that were used but not registered. Some of them were used for a short while, disappeared again, but 255 were still visible on August 1st of last year. If you look closer at them, 250 of them are in ripe NCC ranges. We then went to the basement of the ripe NCC, looked in all other files other than the statistics files, found that these were mainly old registrations 10 years ago or more. Digging through more files, we found some data on 214. So the problem here is that, well, these ASs are properly registered. They are in the files. They just don't show up on the publicly available files. So that's something that can be corrected. And there is one AS which we found, and we still don't have any idea who owns this AS, who is using it, and how, if and how it was registered. Of the remainder, 40 are in Aaron's ranges. Those have been reported to Aaron. And good thing for APNIC is that their mechanism is perfect. None of these 255 are in Aaron's ranges. We also found 7 ASs that were used and are not in any RAR range. This is presumably a problem with transferring of data. Over the years, records were moved from one registry to another, and 7 of them sort of fell through the cracks. So people often ask about how accurate the data in these registry files is. So one upper limit is, say, well, we have 33,000 assigned, there are 41 with no data, so that's like 0.1%, and it's probably a lot less. And given that this is a mechanism that has been running for like 15 years or so, well, 0.1% of registrations with no data is pretty good. So next thing is total number of ASs seen. And here there are 2 curves. The blue and the purple one, that's what's assigned, and in blue, that's the AS count. So that's data available from 2002, and then the purple line is working your way backwards, just simply removing everything from the first file, statistics files, working your way backwards. So, and then in red is what you see in the RIS, and in green is what you see in the CIDR report. If you look at this plot, you see a couple of things. First of all, you see this is a fairly straight line, and you see it rise. And this is sort of in 1999, at the start of the internet bubble. You see this effect in both what's assigned and what's out there on the net. Now, the internet bubble lasted for a couple of years. And in 2002, late 2001, early 2002, it ended. And you see this effect in what you see on the net. The growth went clearly to a lower pace. However, you don't see that in what's assigned. So people are still making plans, still getting ASs assigned, they just don't appear on the net. The other thing, you see down here what's seen on the net and what's assigned. These are pretty much parallel lines. So yes, there's some number of ASs missing, but it's fairly constant. However, if you look at the last couple of years, well, the slope is different, and the number of ASs missing is growing. For modeling later on, if you look at this curve, you can ask yourself, okay, is this lit? What's the behavior? Well, we looked at it, and we think that the growth of the number of ASs assigned is linear. We did a couple of tests. We fitted these curves to linear and exponential curves. Linear clearly describes it best. Also, if you look at the derivatives, it still seems to be linear. And just a plot to show that. This is the last couple of years. Red's the data, the solid black line is linear, and the dotted line is exponential. You see that at the start, at the end, exponential starts to deviate, which is an indication that this is more linear than exponential. And we'll use that slide later on. Growth rates. So how many ASs are appearing every month? There are two lines here. Well, there are three lines here, but the most important one is the red one. That's new allocations every month. And the blue line, that is what's disappearing. If you look at the red line, sort of for the last, since 2002, it's pretty much flat at about 284 per month. Also, what's disappearing is pretty flat. It's about 100 a month. And one thing that you should note is this peak at the end. And I'll explain this on the next slide. So these are growth rates for all five registries. So I then split it up into various regions. And the first thing is Aaron. And here there are three curves. There is in red, new assignments. In green, new plus reassignments. So an AS is used, apparently returned or recovered, sits in the pool for a while, shows up again. And in blue, there's what's disappearing. And you see a couple of things. First thing is, well, from 2002 till mid-2004, basically there was no recovery. And then Aaron started to recover ASs. And that's seen here, the blue area. Second thing you see is that the green and the red line, so new assignments from the completely never used pool and assignments from that were used before, are starting to deviate. So some of this, what is being recovered, is being reassigned up here. You then look at the right hand CC, same plots. Notice a couple of things. Very little recovery. And the other thing is that the trend seems to go up. I mean, this is clearly going up. And so far, this is compensated by Aaron's recovery efforts, so that makes it the whole thing is still going as a linear curve. If Aaron ever stops doing this, or if they have recovered everything they can possibly recover, the growth might turn from linear into an exponential again. APNIC, well, same thing. There is some recovery. There was clearly a huge recovery effort somewhere early 2003. Next plot is the fraction of ASs that's seen. So I just took everything assigned over time and divided it by what's shown up on the net. And what you see here is basically, okay, so this is 1998. 1998 was only 40%, but it has been growing up quite nicely, but for the last couple of years, it's pretty flat at about 63% of what's assigned is actually visible on the net. And there's some numbers here. Well, on August 1st of last year, 33,000 were assigned, 20,000 were in the race, so that's the 60%. And of the difference, 7,000 were never used, and 5,000 were used for a while, but they were retired. Next interesting observation is the age of retired ASs, and that's shown on this plot. So we plotted how long an AS was seen before it disappeared from the net. And what you see here is this nice peak and then it drops off. which simply means that people use it, use an AS, and this is in a month, so something like 50 or 60 months, and then it disappears. So people somehow seem to think that ASs go stale. You can also plot this over time. So this is a plot, this is time, and this is a fraction of ASs used. So this is time when AS was assigned, and this is the fraction that's still used. This is 2005, this is 2004. Well, in 2004, the AS is assigned in 2004, about 80% was used, and it goes down pretty rapidly. So things that were assigned 10 years ago, only 40% was still active. Next thing I looked at, wait a second. So why does this drop? Well, there are basically two effects that cause these drops. Well, first thing is sites go out of business. When a site goes out of business, the need for an AS obviously disappears. But yeah, people are sort of scrambling out, getting their CVs ready, trying to find a new job, and the last thing on their mind is send an email to the registry telling us, oh yes, we got this AS from you, here you can have it back. And like we saw, there are very little recovery efforts by the RIAs. Second thing that happens is that networks merge. If two networks merge, need for one AS often disappears. But again, there's no incentive to return it to the unused pool. And people often say, well, we merge our networks, AS1 and AS2. Well, we all called AS1 now. But yeah, why bother to return AS2? Let's just leave it on the shelf. Maybe a customer comes up and we don't have to go through the registration process and apply for a new one. So that's basically causing this drop. Then there's activation delay. How long does it take for an AS that you apply for to appear on the net? And this is data for the APNIC region. So on the bottom is days since assignment, and the difference in days between assignment and appearance in the RIS. And the three curves, red, green, blue, and purple, are the various years. You can see a couple of things. First thing is, if you wait 2 months, 60 days, about 40% appears on the net. If you wait 200 days, so a little over half a year, about 2 out of 3 has appeared on the net. If you wait for a really long time, a year and a half, but essentially this curve, as you can see, it flattens off and continues to be flat forever. So 80% only appears after a year and a half, and then it's fairly constant. So the other way you can look at this, well, 20% of the ASs that has been assigned never makes it to the net. So that's just an observation. Then I looked at the policies, and all the regions have policies on what you have to do with an AS. Aaron, if you read the policy, it says there must be plans to use an ASN within 30 days after assignment. In the RIPNCC area, there is actually no policy, but there was a discussion on the mailing list a few years ago, and the agreement was sort of, okay, if you apply for it, you must use it within 3 months. Here in the APNIC region, policy is that you must meet the requirements when you get an ASN, or reasonably soon thereafter, and they nicely left out the definition of reasonably. So, if you look at the policies and this plot of a couple of slides ago, in practice this is different. I mean, they all say, well, a month, three months, soon, but in practice the time between assignment and appearance on the net is a lot longer. And the second problem is that 20% of the AS's that are assigned never make it to the nets, even though people could somehow show to the rich the rear that they needed one. So, those are the raw numbers. We then did some modeling on the data. And the first question that people have asked is, when will the internet run out of 16-bit AS numbers? Like I said on the first slide, there are 64,000 available of them. 33,000 were assigned on August 1st of last year, which means that 30,000 are still available. We have 284 assignments per month. If you divide 30,000 by 284, you end up with about 108 months, which means that you run out in 2013 and 2016. That's, well, 7-8 years. And, yeah, 7 years is sort of worrisome, since, yeah, if we cannot have any AS in 7 years, what do we have to do then? So, first thing you can do is, instead of solving the problem, postponing the problem. Can we make the pool last longer? Yeah, we can. Well, first we can reclaim what disappears. 284 minimum is 105. You only go up to 179 per month. And you postpone the problem to 2016 to 2024. Can even make it be a little bit more aggressive by also reclaiming what is not never used. You go down to 160 assignments per month, and the period you have left is 23 years. Yeah, if that's not long enough, next thing is, okay, let's make the AS a bit longer. There is a solution around it. There's a proposal to use 4 bytes or 32 bits for the AS numbers. That gives you 40 billion AS numbers, and with 40 billion we can last at least 1 million years. And I'm not going to make any more detailed predictions than that. There is actually a draft that has been around in the IDR working group for a long time with an extension of AS numbers from 16 to 32 bits. There is now, based on this work and similar studies by Jeff Houston, a policy proposal in all 5 regions, which basically says we'll start handing them out. Okay, handing out is one thing. It also has to be implemented. So you have to update your routers, get the stuff deployed, which means talk to your vendor and say, well, we're going to need this in a couple of years. So whenever you build a new router or update software of it, make sure that this draft is implemented. And that's something that requires a push from your side. Other ways to make things last longer. Well, you can obviously, if you don't want 32 bits ASs and don't want to upgrade your kit, well, we might think about changing policies. You see, well, current policies are based on demonstrated needs. Only 63% is actively used, 20% never makes it to the net. So one thing you can say, it's probably too easy to demonstrate needs. So revisit the policies. But that's something for the policy working groups of the various RIRs, not for this forum. A couple of words about reclamation. The essential thing in this game is uniqueness. You want an AS to be unique. You don't want a situation where it has been handed out. We see that it's not being used. Well, it's reassigned, and suddenly the first person who got it starts using it again. And so far, there's no good mechanism for recovery. Solution to that might be the certification efforts which are going on in the APNIC and the RIPE region. Certification is very simple. Each AS comes with a certificate that shows that it's assigned to somebody. This certificate is valid for, say, a 1 year period. You can always renew it if you still need it, so you never have a need to renumber. And, well, if you get an AS, you start to use it, and after a year, you still need the AS, well, renew it. If you don't need it, well, the certificate will expire as time goes on, and the resource can be reused. This has one requirement, and that is that people actually check these certificates when setting up pairing sessions. However, that's probably something that will become standard practice when secure routing is deployed. So, to conclude, what we see at the moment is that there are 284 ASs assigned per month from the unused pool. The actual growth is only 160. If we start with this 284, the pool will be empty by sometime between 2013 and 2016. There are ways to make it last longer: reclamation, certification. If people want to do this, okay, the pool will last longer, can postpone the problem. If people don't want to do this, you should really start to think about deploying 4-byte ASs. So that's what I wanted to say. We have a lot more results, and there's a full write-up in a technical report available from the RIPE website. And with that, okay, I have to acknowledge a couple of people who helped getting all this data, and two transport companies who caused so many delays that I had time to work on this while waiting for planes and trains. And with that, any questions?
Any questions for Hank at all? David.
Hi. I'm wondering, do you think there should be global consistency with regards to the ASN reclamation policies?
It would be good if this... My personal opinion would be that it would be good if this was done sort of by all five RERs across the board,
there's
no advantage to go to one registry or there are policy differences. But I don't really have an opinion on this.
Chris Jondy. The one that you said was totally unknown early on in the talk. Surely you've got the path information from the RIB, and surely the people that AS number is connected to know that AS number is connected.
You can find out something, but it's it's more like inside the RIPNCC building, we couldn't find any data on who got that AS. And
okay, no other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much, Hank. So that really brings us to the end of the Routing SIG, the two sessions. I would like to thank all the seven speakers that we've had this afternoon for their presentations. Finished a few minutes early, so you've really got probably about 40 minutes now between this session and the APOPS BOF, which is the next meeting in this room. Just a reminder, the APNIC social event is tonight, so those of you who've got tickets to that, please remember the last bus leaves at 7:10. If you are late, you will miss it, and you'll miss the social. So please be there on time. And directions for the transport are on the back of the ticket, in case you're wondering what to do. Otherwise, thank you all for coming. Thanks very much to the stenographers for the excellent work on the screen to my left. And see you at the next Routing SIG. In 6 months' time. Thank you.